The litany of failure, of man's helplessness, hopelessness, futility, surrounds us today. It's encapsulated in two widespread bromides. Epistemologically, nothing is certain but death and taxes. Ethically, life is hell. The first tells us that thought is doomed. It can never attain its goal, which is knowledge of reality. Our minds are useless. The second tells us that action is doomed. It can never attain its goal, which is the achievement of values. Our lives are useless. Now, this is malevolent universe, or the tragic sense of life, as it's often called, across the board in epistemology and in ethics. And most people accept it as self-evident, as uncontroversial. Objectivism, of course, holds the exact opposite viewpoint. We hold that certainty is possible and that happiness is possible. And more, we believe that certainty and happiness are not only possible, but the norm of human existence. We believe that men not only should be successful in thought and action, they should expect to be successful and refuse to settle for anything else. What is the source of these two opposite approaches to philosophy? What does the objectivist viewpoint rest on philosophically, and what does the conventional viewpoint rest on? What are the deepest ideas that explain the philosophy of success, as we may call it, as against the philosophy of failure? To answer, we have to first grasp the connection between the two issues of certainty and happiness, or putting it negatively, between skepticism and malevolence. One of these issues comes from epistemology, one from ethics, yet they're intimately connected. I first noticed the relationship between these topics when I was organizing my present book on objectivism, trying to work out the exact proper logical structure of the great number of topics that are included. And I noticed that each of these topics, logically speaking, is the very last one in its department. Certainty is the final topic of epistemology. It's the culmination and conclusion of the subject, which presupposes all the other topics as its precondition. Similarly, happiness, logically, is the final topic of ethics. It's the culmination of the field, which presupposes that all the virtues and other values have already been covered. Both these issues, in short, are summations. They are like indicators or pointers telling us what the previous philosophizing adds up to. So it's hardly surprising that within a philosophy, the two pointers point in the same direction, whether it be positive or negative. What I want to do this evening is first review the objectivist position on these two topics, certainty and happiness, covering the standard essential points, and in each case, a few points that I hope will be new to you. In any event, they have not yet been in print or given by me in lecture form. And then at the end, I'd like to stand back and see if we can identify the common root underlying objectivism's positive attitude on both these topics as against the widespread negative attitude. Let's start with the discussion of certainty as viewed by objectivism. Now, I'm going to, because I have to, take for granted here the bulk of the objectivist epistemology, including your knowledge that logic is necessary and that certainty is contextual. I want to plunge in tonight with the issue of why the concept of certain comes up to begin with. If the mind were capable of only two states, knowledge and ignorance, then there would be only two verdicts to define an idea's epistemological status: validated or unknown. In fact, however, inherent in the mind's need of logic is a third intermediate status, which applies for an interval of time to certain complex higher level conclusions. In these cases, the validation of the idea is a protracted, drawn out, gradual process, a process of accumulating evidence step by step until in the end, the idea is seen to qualify as true or false. In regard to such ideas, not all ideas, but this specific category of ideas, one moves from ignorance to knowledge through a continuum of transitional cognitive states. And the main divisions of this continuum, of course, are identified by three concepts: possible, probable, certain. The first range of the continuum is covered by possible. Now, you know the standard objectivist doctrine. I'm sure on this point, a conclusion is possible if there is some but not much evidence in favor of it and nothing known that contradicts it. Now, this last condition is obviously required. A conclusion that contradicts known facts is false. But that is not by itself sufficient to support a verdict of possible. There are countless gratuitous claims in regard to which one cannot cite any contradictory fact because they are inherently detached from facts, such as the claim that there's a convention of gremlins at the back of the room. But the fact that you can't cite any contradictory fact does not confer on such claims any cognitive status. For an idea to qualify as possible, there must be a certain amount of evidence that positively supports it. If there is no such evidence, the idea falls under a different concept. Not possible, but what? Arbitrary. Arbitrary statements, of course, are effusions unrelated to the evidential continuum outside the realm of cognition. In other words, possible, like any legitimate term, denotes an objective concept. It does not offer anybody an epistemological free ride or blank check. To say maybe is to make a definite claim. It's to assert a given idea's positive relationship to the evidential continuum. And like any other cognitive claim, this must be objectively demonstrated in any particular case. Now that's pretty, I think, clear-cut objectivist doctrine. I want to go a step further now. I said for an idea to qualify as possible, there must be a certain amount of evidence that positively supports it. What is evidence? Something new. I start with the Oxford English Dictionary, an excellent place to start, if you know how to read it selectively. Quote, evidence is testimony or facts tending to prove or disprove any conclusion. Testimony or facts tending to prove or disprove any conclusion. To determine objectively whether or not a given datum is evidence for a claim, therefore, one must first define what proof of that claim would consist of. Then, by reference to this standard, one has to demonstrate that the datum, although inconclusive, actually contributes to such proof. In other words, actually strengthens the claim logically and thus moves the matter closer to a cognitive resolution. Did you get that point? Let me just reiterate the central point here. To determine whether or not something is evidence, you have to first define what proof of that particular claim would consist of. Then you have to demonstrate that the fact in question, even though it's inconclusive, actually contributes to a proof, strengthens the claim logically, moves the matter closer to a cognitive resolution. This means that if one has no idea what the proof of a given conclusion would consist of, or if one holds that a proof of it is inherently impossible, one has no means of deciding whether or not a given piece of information, quote, tends to prove it. In other words, if the terminus of a journey is undefined or unknowable, there is no way to judge whether or not one is moving toward it. And this is why there can be no such thing as, quote, some evidence, unquote, in favor of God. Now, I'm not going far beyond the claim that there's no proof of God. I'm saying there can be no such thing as, quote, some evidence in favor of God or any mystical dimension that's claimed to transcend logic and nature. The term evidence in this context would be a stolen concept, since nothing can ever qualify as proof of such a dimension. There is no way to identify any data as a part proof of it either. There is no way to validate such a notion as that which brings men closer to knowing the unknowable or proving the unprovable. Now, by contrast, let's take an obvious example. We do know what kind of information would demonstrate a murderer's guilt. In regard to this kind of conclusion, the requirements of logical proof have been objectively defined. By reference to this knowledge, we can then proceed to identify certain data as relevant or evidentiary, while setting aside other information as irrelevant. Here's a schematic working out. If a man who hated the victim was present at the scene of his shooting, then other things being equal, you can legitimately conclude maybe he did it. Because to establish motive and opportunity in a murder case does move the cognitive matter forward. Since you know what would constitute a full case against a suspect, you're able to grasp that this information, even though it's not a full case, is at least part of what is needed. On the other hand, you cannot justify a maybe in this situation by citing the facts that a given man had visited the victim a month earlier and disliked his taste in ties or murder mysteries. Such information has no tendency to establish an individual's guilt. By itself, it does not provide any part of a proper logical case against a suspect. Of course, I don't deny that in some contexts, information of this kind might warrant an investigation to determine whether evidence justifying a hypothesis can be found elsewhere, but that will take us into infinity. Now, for the same reason, general information about the capacities or potentialities of a species does not by itself constitute evidence supporting a hypothesis about a particular one of its members. From man is capable of murder, you cannot infer maybe Dr. Buechner is the killer we are seeking. To validate the latter, you must have some grounds to suspect that the general human capacity to murder was actually exercised in this case by this particular individual. To give you another example, which I'm sure is familiar to you of this because it's appeared in articles of mine, it's possible for a human being to run the mile in less than 4 minutes, and it's possible for a living organism to reproduce after its kind. These capacities are real under the appropriate circumstances. But I can't go over to a crippled gentleman in his wheelchair and say maybe you'll give birth to a son next week after you've run the mile to the hospital in 3.9 minutes. After all, you're a living human being, and it's possible for such an entity to do these things. It is possible for man does not justify it is possible that this man. The latter claim depends on the individual involved and on the specific conditions. It must therefore be supported by data that are commensurately specific. Now, like all cognitive claims, possibilities are asserted within a context. If and when it changes, the verdict must change accordingly. The initial possibility may be weakened or even erased, or it may be strengthened. If favorable evidence continues to be discovered, at a certain point the claim will no longer be merely possible, it will become probable. Probable indicates a higher range of the evidential continuum. And here is my formal definition now, unveiled. A conclusion is probable if the burden of a substantial amount of evidence, although still inconclusive, is in favor of it. In this case, there are not merely some supporting data, but a relatively extensive accumulation, although these data have not yet reached the standard of proof. And because they haven't, there are still objective grounds on which to remain in doubt about the ultimate verdict, which must accordingly be left open. Now, to continue our example, if the investigation of the shooting reveals, say, only three suspects with motive and at least the appearance of opportunity, and one of these subsequently proves to have an ironclad alibi, and of the remaining two, one has a known familiarity with firearms, and this man answers police questions evasively and has a criminal record, then as this kind of data mounts up, the burden of a substantial body of evidence increasingly points to one individual who thus becomes the likeliest suspect. Although so far, there are still grounds for doubt. Now, to stress here, these grounds for doubt are defined by reference to the standard of proof in this kind of case. Since we know what would constitute conclusive demonstration here, we know that so far we've still not reached it. For instance, we have not yet established, if you know murder mysteries, means. In other words, the suspect's access to the murder weapon. Like possibilities, probabilities also are asserted within a context and may be weakened or strengthened as it changes. A favorable evidence for a probability continues to be discovered. At some point, the climax, cognitively speaking, will be reached. The conclusion ceases to be a hypothesis and becomes knowledge. That is when we call it certain. Now, the concept of certainty, therefore, designates knowledge viewed from a particular perspective. It designates knowledge considered in contrast to the transitional evidential states that often precede it. Did you get that? Now, I just want to note here that linguistically, we can apply it to all knowledge, the term certain. By extension, we can apply it to percepts as well as to concepts, simply to indicate that it's free of doubt. Basically, in that usage, you're using it as a club to deny skepticism. But as a concept that is important and essential to human cognition, it would not arise on the perceptual level because there should properly be no skeptics walking around saying, I doubt that your senses are reliable and requiring, therefore, an answer. Properly speaking, in its primary usage, certain applies only to conceptual material and only to complex, higher-level conclusions. Simple, direct, ostensive propositions, even on the conceptual level, don't go through any transitional stage, and therefore no such concept as certain is properly required for them. In its primary usage, therefore, certain designates knowledge looked at as the product of a complex transitional stage. And a conclusion is certain, therefore, this is the formal definition, when the evidence in favor of it is conclusive. In other words, when it has been logically validated. At this stage, there is not merely substantial evidence to support the idea. The total of the available evidence points in a single direction, and this evidence fulfills the standard of proof. Now, I have to stress this latter point because this is a departure from those of you who have taken my 1976 lectures. I feel that they were misleading in the definition of certainty that was offered, because I stressed at that point that certain was defined as simply the total of the available evidence points in a certain direction. That is actually true, but it is not a satisfactory definition, because there are a great many cases where the total of the available evidence is insufficient to warrant any definite conclusion. For instance, suppose the only thing we have to go by is some fingerprints in our murder case, and that's the total of the evidence, and they happen to be Professor Buechner's fingerprints. That does not make him certainly the murderer, even though that is the totality of the evidence available. So I think it is a mistake, the definition that I offered in 76, although my heart was in the right place, but it must be that the total of the available evidence points in a single direction, and this evidence fulfills the standard of proof. And then in such a context, there's nothing to suggest even the possibility of another interpretation. And there are therefore no longer any objective grounds on which to doubt the truth or to keep the final verdict open. And then to conclude on our example, the further investigation reveals that the likeliest suspect was also, by the testimony of the gun seller, the purchaser of the murder weapon. And that the killer, judging by the nature of the wound, must have been left-handed, and so is this suspect. And that his fingerprints are on the gun, while the only other suspect has no known connection to the weapon, is right-handed, and has no idea how to work or shoot a gun. Then, in this kind of evidential context, and note we have no eyewitness, but nevertheless, in this kind of evidential context, a definite conclusion emerges. If one and only one individual has motive, opportunity, and means, he is the culprit. That is the standard of proof. And in this case, I've taken it from what great historical figure, the formulation? Hercule Poirot, correct. That's from Agatha Christie. At this point, but the point is that in any discussion of certainty, you must have a principle of that kind, which is the standard of proof. And here it happens to be very simple to formulate. In a certain complex inductive context, is murder to formulate. But you cannot discuss probability or possibility until you know what the standard of certainty would consist of. And in my opinion, answering a question here off the cuff that was asked in one of the written questions, the whole problem with the philosophy of science is how to formulate the theory of arriving at the standards of proof in various epistemological contexts. Thankfully, that is not our topic tonight. Certainty, like possibility and probability, is contextual. It's a verdict reached within a definite context of evidence, and it stands or falls with the evidence. For example, a defense attorney could not save the suspect in the case we've been discussing by dropping the context and uttering a string of arbitrary maybes, such as, maybe the gun seller lied, maybe the fingerprints are a frame-up, maybe the criminal record is a mix-up, maybe the suspect was really in Tibet and everyone who placed him at the murder scene was hypnotized, etc. The question that you have to ask to counter all of these maybes is, within the total context, are there any objective data to support any of these hypotheses? If there are not, none qualifies as possible and none is admissible in any discussion of the proper cognitive assessment. Now, this kind of context dropping of this hypothetical defense attorney is precisely the stock in trade of the zealots against certainty. You can see it in action in their biggest argument, which is the so-called problem of error. Now, the nature of this problem is best brought out by a dialogue between a skeptic and his opponent who has just offered an argument to defend some viewpoint. Imagine that you're the opponent. You've just offered an argument, let's say, in favor of the superiority of capitalism over communism. Let's say you've given a long, complex, detailed argument. The skeptic now, he's not a communist, he's a skeptic. He listens to you and he says, I'm condensing, 20 minutes into one, man is fallible. Even with the best of training and intentions, he's capable of error. So how can you be certain that you're not wrong? you say to him, well, man's general capacity to err does not by itself warrant a hypothesis of error in a particular case. You see, that's the exact analogy to the capacity to murder doesn't warrant a hypothesis of murder. And you say, I've just given you a specific validation to demonstrate that in this case I am right. The skeptic comes back. What is his obvious counterclaim? You say you've given a validation. What does he say in real life? But your validation itself might have made a mistake. It might be fallacious. How do you know it isn't? You say, well, can you point to any sign of my fallacy, a flaw in my reasoning, a fact I've neglected, a term I've improperly defined, something? Now, can the skeptic do it? No, at this point he's stopped. Because if he were to identify specific fallacies, he would thereby be entering the field of knowledge in a particular case and conceding that he is able to assess the evidence and distinguish truth from error. For instance, suppose he jumped in and said, well, capitalism is no good. What about all the monopolies that have littered the pages of history? You've overlooked that fact. What would you have to say to him as a skeptic? Fact? How can you as a skeptic say such a thing? What do you know about monopolies? Whether there's been monopolies? What is a monopoly? Who knows? That's why skeptics will never be specific. It's not that they're, you know, willfully evasive. They are methodologically evasive. They cannot enter the discussion and tell you a specific thing you did wrong because they have overthrown skepticism in the process. That is why a dialogue with a skeptic has to end with the skeptic simply sweeping aside the whole context and declaring, I can't specify or detect your error, but maybe it's there. I can't tell the difference between your argument and a perfectly valid one, but still I'm not sure. Prove that this non-detectable error does not exist. Certainty, to sum up, is a contextual assessment, and in countless situations, the context permits no other. Despite the claims of skeptics, doubt is not the human fate, with cognition being an unattainable ideal. On the contrary, doubt rationally exercised is a temporary transitional state, which is applicable only to higher level questions of some degree of complexity, and which itself, that is the fact of doubt itself, expresses a cognitive judgment, namely that the evidence one has is still inconclusive, which requires in itself a twofold knowledge in the doubter's mind. He has to know what is known so far and what more is required to reach full proof. To doubt legitimately, you must already possess a vast context of knowledge that is beyond the realm of doubt, including a knowledge of fact and of logic and of how, in principle, your doubt is eventually to be removed. Doubt, which is not arbitrary or pathological, is necessarily a self-limiting condition, both in scope and in duration. It is not the norm of the mind, but at most a frequent stage on the road to the norm, which, when reached, ends it. So, is man capable of certainty? There's only one answer. Yes. Certainly. Yeah. Now let's make the switch over to the topic of happiness. I'm going to try to walk with all these wires to the water. Oh, here it is. Happiness. Objectivism holds that just as certainty is the normal condition of the mind, so happiness is the normal condition of the soul. And let's review why this is so. Reminding ourselves of the essential point step by step in the objectivist philosophy of happiness, as we can call it. Now, I want to start here with a term that's broader than happiness, the term pleasure. I'm using the term for the moment to designate any form of enjoyment or delight. And the first thing to note, logically, if we develop this topic, is that pleasure is an effect. Its cause is the gaining of a value, whether it be a meal when you're hungry, a sign of love from your girlfriend or boyfriend, an A at school, or a long-sought promotion at work. What is the root of values, in turn, of an organism's need of values? Obviously, the requirements of survival. So we can synopsize this point by saying self-preservation entails goal-directed action, success at which leads to pleasure, that is, in the case of conscious organisms. And thus, the objectivist principle that pleasure is a concomitant of life. It's the inherent consequence in conscious organisms of successful goal-directed action, which is inherent in life. And pain, by the same reasoning, is a concomitant of the opposite. Now, you know Ayn Rand's point on the physical level that the pleasure-pain mechanism is a barometer of one's basic alternative. The sensation of physical pleasure indicates that one is satisfying in some form a biological need, and to that extent is following a right course of action. The sensation of physical pain is a warning that something is wrong. It indicates some lack or damage that requires corrective action. Now, you know on this level the mechanism is automatic. The standard of value that determines bodily right and wrong is set innately. And of course, the standard is the organism's life. Now, we need a clarification here. I said that physical pleasure indicates you're following a right course of action. If you eat nothing but birthday cakes for 6 weeks then and have continuous pleasure, is that a right course of action? Or I said the sensation of physical pain is a warning that something is wrong. Does it follow you should never go to the dentist because it hurts? And therefore it's a sign that something is wrong if you drills your teeth. Obviously, you can't interpret that point in this way. A sensation does not necessarily indicate long-range consequences. It cannot, therefore, be followed blindly. Too many sweets may give pleasure in the moment, but then lead to the pains of stomach ache, tooth decay, you fill in the blanks. Even in this kind of case, however, the principle holds true, that is, of the pleasure-life correlation. The pleasure derives from the fact that sugar does satisfy a biological need. And because the excessive intake is harmful, its eventual consequence is pain. Similarly, the pain from the dentist drilling does indicate that some nerve tissue is being destroyed, which in this instance serves the organism's life. The long-range result, therefore, other things being equal, is the sensory glow that accompanies unimpaired vitality. So the principle is true, but can't be taken, let's say simplistically, out of context. Just as the body has the pleasure-pain sensations to protect and guide it, so consciousness has two fundamental emotions, which Ayn Rand calls joy and suffering, as a barometer of the same alternative, life or death. Joy is the result of gaining a chosen value, one held on the conceptual level, as against an innate physiological value. And suffering is the result of loss or failure in this regard, that is, in regard to a chosen value formulated and reached on the conceptual level. Now, that brings us to happiness, which is a type of joy, an enduring and fundamental form of joy. So, if you want a chart for your tuition, I would put it, the broadest term here is pleasure in the widest sense, in a broad sense, meaning any form of enjoyment or delight, whatever its source. And then that breaks up into pleasure in the sensory sense, that is from the taste of the cake or whatever, and joy on the conceptual volitional level. And then joy can be temporary and superficial or fundamental and enduring. And when it reaches that particular form of joy, that is what we call happiness. So that's how it would go on a chart of the derivation of concepts. Now, Ayn Rand's formal definition of happiness is what? No, she also said, she was very strong on the point that an emotion must be defined by reference to the type of cause. You cannot define an emotion simply by reference to another emotion. To make it objective, you have to try to relate it to external reality by defining in some way its relation to the cause. And she has a sentence in Galt's speech giving a formal objectivist definition of happiness, which is intended as a definition. If you use up your time now, then you're going to be shot for the question. Yeah. Yes. Excellent. The state of consciousness which proceeds from the achievement of one's values. And now I want to analyze that definition. On the conceptual level, as we know, the standard of value determining human responses is not automatic. Chosen values are not necessarily in harmony with the requirements of survival. On the contrary, a person can hold and pursue irrational values and thereby gain pleasure of a sort from the process of harming himself. Now, this kind of person inverts his emotional barometer, turning it into an agent of destruction. The mechanism becomes not his protector, but like a siren or demon urging him to self-destruction. For example, the people whose pleasure in life comes from crime or drugs or idleness or power lust or being accepted by the group, and you can, I'm sure, add extensively to that brief list. Pleasure, however, is a concomitant of life. That principle remains unalterable. And you cannot, therefore, reach happiness by any of these means. You cannot because an anti-life course is an anti-value course. In other words, one incompatible with successful goal-directed action. Now, I here assume you know the objectivist moral code, but just to summarize the relevant point here, the moral man is the exponent of self-preservation. According to objectivism, he is the man who uses his cognitive faculty, reason, to make the countless decisions involved in choosing values and pursuing goals. Only he, the moral man, selects ends and means consonant with the nature of existence and with the integrity of his own consciousness. Only he refuses to sabotage his person or his goals by indulging in out-of-context desires or fears. Only he, therefore, is practical, in other words, able to achieve his values. And only he, therefore, can reach the emotional result and reward of such achievement. So we reach this crucial principle. The moral, the practical, and the happy cannot be sundered. By their nature, these three form a unity. And the explanation is in this principle. He who perceives reality is able to gain his ends and thus enjoy the process of being alive. He who perceives reality, the moral, is able to gain his ends, the practical, and thus enjoy the process of being alive, the happy. By the same token, the evil, the impractical, and the unhappy necessarily form a unity. He who evades, the immoral, renders himself impotent, the impractical, and thus experiences life as suffering, the unhappy. When Ayn Rand says that happiness proceeds from the achievement of one's values, this does not mean from the gaining of any ends, rational or otherwise. If a man holds and achieves rational values, he will be happy as a result, and his happiness will reflect the fact that his course of action is pro-life. If he holds irrational values, however, he may attain a particular out-of-context goal or even several of them, but he cannot, quote, achieve his values. He cannot do it. Why not? Well, that's not true. Some of my values don't exist, but in theory they could be achieved. There's a deeper reason. If he holds irrational values, They involve inherent chronic clashes with one another and with reality, and they therefore cannot be achieved. The simplest example is any neurotic who tries to achieve self-esteem through universal love. He is in a position where he cannot achieve his value. Whatever he does, he loses. If people shower him with love and he molds his personality to invite that love, he hates himself for doing it. On the other hand, if he stands up for what he thinks and doesn't get their love, he's miserable. He's lost. There is no course of action, whatever. No myth, no fantasy that could project, quote, achieving your values if you hold a value like that. If you want a political example, I refer you to my chapter on the concentration camps where the Nazis' value was absolute power. And insofar as they achieved it, they had nothing left to have power over. Their goal was to have functioning, active, thinking human beings who were absolute pawns of absolute power. And they simply couldn't achieve it. It's a goal in conflict with reality. Now, those are two examples of the point of why this definition, happiness is that which proceeds from the achievement of one's values. You must keep in mind that irrational values cannot be achieved. A given irrational goal can be achieved. Like Hitler can annihilate Poland, but he can't achieve what he's annihilating it for. The irrational man, in other words, has to be tortured. And this is the way I word it at present. In his approach to the world, failure means suffering, and so does success. Success of his kind, in other words, that blanking out or fighting reality, is a threat. Attainment is anxiety. Desire is guilt. Pleasure is laced with hangover. Joy is overcome by pain. Now, whatever you call that state, it's not happiness. And this is why Ayn Rand's very crucial elaboration of her definition. This is not a definition, but a very essential elaboration. Happiness, she writes, I'll just take a moment to quote this passage from Galt's speech. It's a state of non-contradictory joy. A joy without penalty or guilt. A joy that does not clash with any of your values and does not work for your own destruction. Not the joy of escaping from your mind, but of using your mind's fullest power. Not the joy of faking reality, but of achieving values that are real. Not the joy of a drunkard, but of a producer. That's an elaboration of the theoretical point we've been making. Now I want to consider the tie between rationality and happiness from another aspect. If happiness involves the achievement of values, let's focus on the word values. It demands values as against whims. In other words, a conviction of the rightness of one's goals and a consequent passion to attain them, as against indulgence in arbitrary pursuits and consequent uncertainty. Or to put it another way, it requires purpose as against drifting. Now, if you know the objectivist ethics, you know that the rational man fulfills this requirement, and the irrational man does not. Insofar as he is irrational, what moves him is not the quest for positives, but the avoidance of negatives. If we put it in psychological parlance, not healthy self-assertion, but neurotic defensiveness. Or if we put it in Ayn Rand's words, not motivation by love, but motivation by fear. Now, love in this context means the desire to gain and enjoy a value. Fear means the desire to escape a disvalue. The distinction pertains to a man's primary motive in a given field or undertaking. For example, the man who struggles to create something new in his work, who may, as part of the process, have to fight many obstacles placed in his path. As against the man who wants merely not to get blamed by the boss or not to get fired. The man who seeks a passionate romance with a kindred spirit versus the man who sleeps with anyone because all he wants is not to be left alone. The man who tends to his health in order to be free to live and act versus the hypochondriac obsessed with not being sick. The man who turns to Rachmaninoff for melody and inspiration versus the man who turns to Schoenberg in order not to be passé and not to be too awake. The presidential candidate who has something to say in a TV debate, who wants to make a case to the country and win the argument, versus the candidate who wants only not to make any mistakes on screen and not to lose. Now, in one sense, both of these types of men can be described as purposive, in the sense that they're both acting and functioning and pursuing something as against being inanimate like this briefcase. But they are not both exponents of purpose in the sense in which we talk about the value of purpose. They are not purposive in the moral sense, because morality is defined by reference to the requirements of survival. And the goal of life can't be attained by seeking zeros. And I'll permit myself one more brief quote from Galt's speech. Achieving life is not the equivalent of avoiding death. Existence is not a negation of negatives. Evil, not value, is an absence and a negation. So happiness is not an absence either. Nor is it some guilty pleasures that serve merely to lessen anxiety. To put it in the vernacular, it is not what you feel when you stop beating your head against a wall. It is what you feel when you refuse ever to engage in such beating. In other words, when you esteem and protect your head as a matter of principle. Happiness, the reward of life, is an aspect of life. And as such, it too requires value, is not merely avoidance, and therefore a functioning mind. And thus the objectivist point that just as you can't achieve self-preservation arbitrarily, but only by means of reason, so you can't achieve happiness arbitrarily, but only by the same method. And in fact, self-preservation and happiness, of course, are not separate issues. They're the one same indivisible fact looked at from two aspects, external action and internal consequence, or call it biological cause and psychological effect, or existence and consciousness. Now I want to state a few words on the question, granted that virtue is a necessary condition of happiness, is it also a sufficient condition? And the answer is yes, in a real sense, it is. Let's consider here a moral man who has not yet reached professional or romantic fulfillment. An Ayn Rand hero, say like Rourke or Galt, at the point when he is alone against the world, barred from his work, destitute. Now, such a person has certainly not, quote, achieved his values. On the contrary, he is beset by problems and difficulties. Nevertheless, if he is an Ayn Rand hero, he's confident, at peace with himself, serene. He is a happy person, even when living through an unhappy period. He does experience deprivation, frustration, pain. But in a phrase that I think is truly memorable from the Fountainhead, it's pain that goes down only to a certain point. Very, very profound description. And beneath that point are the crucial attributes which this kind of person has built into his soul: reason, purpose, self-esteem. Now, in an important sense, a man of this kind has achieved his values. Not his existential values, but the philosophical values that are their precondition. He has achieved not success, but the ability to succeed. In other words, the right relationship to reality. So the emotional leitmotif of such a person is a unique and enduring form of pleasure. The pleasure that derives from the sheer fact of a man's being alive, if he is a man who feels able to live. Now, you know that I've described this particular emotion in past lectures as what? This type of pleasure. Well, I guess I'm not repeating myself, but metaphysical pleasure, to contrast it to the more specific pleasures of work, friendship, so on. Metaphysical pleasure does not erase the pains inherent in daily life, but by providing a positively toned context for them, it blunts those pains, just as it intensifies one's daily pleasures. The immoral man, by contrast, suffers metaphysical pain. In other words, the enduring anxiety, conflict and self-doubt inherent in being an adversary of reality. This kind of pain intensifies the man's everyday defeat while turning pleasure for him into a superficiality that goes down only to a certain point, which I think is a perfect description of Keating. He can experience pleasure, but only down to a certain point. Now, metaphysical pleasure depends on one's own choices and actions. And in that sense, virtue does ensure happiness. Not the full happiness of having achieved one's values in reality, but the radiance of knowing that such achievement is possible. The one state is represented by Rourke at the end of the novel, standing triumphant atop the Winan building, looking down at Dominic. That is 100% happiness. But the other, which is still happiness, is Rourke at the start and throughout, even in the granite quarry. Now, I have to make two qualifications here. Otherwise, I'm afraid they will be needless and mistaken, guilt or self-doubt on some people's part. Let us say nobody in this room would commit the mistake I have in mind, but someone that you tell this to might. Two qualifications, one pertaining to consciousness and the other to existence. First of all, in today's irrational world, it is easy to imagine a perfectly good, virtuous child being brought up atrociously by parents and teachers, being filled with so many contradictions and subjected to so much injustice and irrationality that he ends up as an adult with a seriously breached view of existence, of other men, of himself. Such a person, even though fully virtuous, might very well be unhappy, tortured by inner conflicts that he cannot identify or resolve. Add to this the fact that psychology is in a primitive state so far. We're still in a complementary sense, the best I can say is the pre-Socratic era of psychology, if we've even hit Thales. And that means that even if the child does go to a psychotherapist, the individual may be unable to help him very much through sheer lack of development of the science. Under these conditions, everyone can easily imagine an honest, virtuous, hard-working person who nevertheless cannot achieve metaphysical pleasure as his inner leitmotif. I have no difficulty imagining such a phenomenon for a moment. The moral of my talk, therefore, is not if you are unhappy, you're vicious. Now, of course, I want to say that I think that an honest individual, whatever his conflicts, is happier by far than his dishonest counterpart. But that doesn't mean that he necessarily feels the basic happiness of Rourke. Now, I regard this, even though it's a very real phenomenon, as a temporary cultural problem, not a philosophic issue. Its root is the corrupt society that we live in and the primitive state of psychology. In time, I believe, as civilization improves, if it does, and as psychology grows, if it does, this kind of case will diminish and finally all but disappear. But for now and for our lifetimes, it's a fact we must remember as a qualification to the principle that virtue leads to happiness. Now, the other qualification I want to make pertains to the existential conditions of a person's life. Assume now a man without psychological problems, a man who has achieved the Rourke soul. He has no crushing conflicts. He has the self-made ability to succeed. Even so, he will not necessarily be happy. The ability to achieve values is useless if the context of your life prevents you from exercising that ability. And there are many existential conditions which could cause that. For instance, just a few. If you're caught in a dictatorship without hope of escape, or you're suffering from a terminal illness, or you lose an irreplaceable person essential to your very existence as a valuer, as may occur in the death of a beloved wife or husband. In these kind of situations, suffering or stoicism is all that's possible. We always have to remember that morality is a means to action in reality. Here's a very important objectivist principle. The soul in and by itself is not an entity, nor an end, nor a fulfillment. That's a Christian view if you think that it's an end or an entity or a fulfillment in itself. Character alone, therefore, moral character alone, in other words, deprived of the necessary existential context, will not produce happiness, not even metaphysical pleasure. Who is the obvious example of that in Ayn Rand's writings? Who had the soul? Well, I was thinking of Leo because Kira tried to escape. In other words, to put it in its simplest form, there is no joy in being alive if you cannot live. So I would say, to sum up these two exceptions, virtue does ensure happiness in the metaphysical sense, except when life itself becomes impossible to a man, because for one reason or another, the pursuit or achievement of values becomes impossible. Now, you're going to let me run on a few minutes. Okay. I mean, you can enforce the terms, you know. I could stop if you want. I wanted to just look briefly at the... What did you say?
I said the audience wanted to shout you down.
I wanted to consider briefly the two views of happiness dominant in today's culture, because that will help to lead us in the direction of the basic question of this evening. And as always, those are the intrinsicist and the subjectivist approach. The intrinsicist approach regards happiness as lower evil. This common subjectivist approach is hedonism. Intrinsicism, as I assume you know, whatever its promises in regard to another life, leads in this one to suffering. Enjoyment as such, accordingly, becomes suspect. It becomes a sign of ethical dereliction, of selfishness, ambition, what is called, quote, materialism. And therefore, on this philosophy, there can be no question of pursuing happiness. Your moral destiny is the opposite, duty, loss, sacrifice. This, of course, is altruism. And this kind of philosophy represents, I think the best way to name it from our present perspective is the adoration of pain, a condition eloquently symbolized in the West by the adoption of crucifixion as an ideal. Now, this kind of adoration has reached unprecedented virulence in our own Kantian era. Now, to an objectivist, the adoration of pain is literally unspeakable in the technical sense of that word. There is nothing to say about it beyond noting that its cause is the righteous rejection of values. In other words, death worship. Now, hedonism may seem to be the opposite viewpoint. Hedonism is the theory that pleasure or happiness is the standard of value. In order to determine values or virtues, the theory holds, you simply ask whether a given object or action maximizes pleasure, whether your own and or that of others. Now, you all know what's wrong with this, I assume. Pleasure is a consequence of a man's antecedent value judgments. So the theory is circular. It amounts to the advice, value that which you or others, for whatever reason, already value. Which means, in practice, do whatever you feel like doing. I would put my objection to hedonism this way. It's self-defeating to counsel the pursuit of pleasure as an ethical guide, because only the pleasure attendant on the achievement of rational values leads to happiness. So the pleasure seeker, if he tried to follow that advice, would first have to distinguish rational values from irrational values before he could act on the advice. And how would he do that? He would need a non-intrinsicist, non-subjectivist, in other words, objective approach to ethics. So the only way to carry out the quest for pleasure, practically speaking, is to become an objectivist. The intrinsicist says, give up your happiness. The subjectivist replies, no, go after it by any random means you choose. The one says pleasure is animalistic, unspiritual, immoral. The other says, true, so let's be animals and grab any kicks we can. Both schools, whatever their disagreements, lead to the same result. the same deflection. Both knock mankind off the road of joy and into the gutter of suffering. Just as, I say parenthetically in epistemology, their counterparts, mysticism and skepticism, knock mankind off the road of knowledge. And of course, this deflection leads most men to conclude that happiness is impossible and that life by its nature is hell. Now, objectivism, by contrast, advocates an objective, this is obvious, approach to ethics, and therefore holds that pleasure is moral, and therefore that happiness is not only possible, but more, that it's the normal condition of man. And this is the conclusion that Ayn Rand called the, what? Benevolent universe premise. Now, I'll give you a definition of benevolent, which I have never given before. In this context of benevolent universe, auspicious to human life. When we say the universe is benevolent, the literal meaning is auspicious to human life. In other words, if a man does recognize and adapt to reality, then he can achieve his values in reality. He can, and other things being equal, he will. So that failures for the moral man, though possible, are an exception to the rule. The rule is success. The state of consciousness to be fought for and expected is happiness. Now, the malevolent universe premise, by contrast, is the view that the universe is antagonistic or hostile to human life, which means that man cannot achieve his values, that successes, though possible, are an exception, that the rule of our life is failure and misery. Now, of course, you know that like any conscious creature, all men, including the man on the benevolent universe premise, is well acquainted with pain. His mark, however, is his refusal to take pain seriously. And thus Dagny's first statement in the valley to John Galt. That is the refusal to grant pain metaphysical significance. To this type of individual, pleasure is a revelation of reality, the reality where life is possible. But pain is not. Pain is merely a stimulus to corrective action and to the question which such action presupposes. And the question is not what's the use, but what can I do? Let me just remind you of a sentence or two from Ragnar Danneskiold here. We do not think that tragedy is our natural fate, and we do not live in chronic dread of disaster. We do not expect disaster until we have specific reason to expect it, and when we encounter it, we are free to fight it. It is not happiness, but suffering that we consider unnatural. Now, this view of the world, if you hold it, in due course becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy, as does its opposite. The man who refuses to blame his problems on reality thereby keeps alive his only means of solving. Now, I want to be clear here what the benevolent universe premise does not say. The benevolent universe premise has nothing to do with, quote, optimism. If this means the idea that all is for the best. A great many things, pick up any newspaper, are clearly for the worst. Nor does the premise mean that the truth will prevail, unless you add one crucial word. What? Ultimately. But ultimately is a long time. Nor is benevolence the same as Pollyannaism. It is not the pretense that there is always a chance of success, even in those situations where there isn't one. But the corrective to all these errors is not, quote, pessimism, which is merely another form of pretense. The corrective is realism. In other words, the recognition of reality along with the knowledge of life which this brings. Namely, that happiness, though scarce, is no miracle. It's scarce. Why? Because it is a culmination which only an extraordinarily demanding cause, moral and philosophical, can produce. And in this respect, I think Spinoza's famous observation is very apt. all things excellent are as difficult as they are rare. In another respect, however, and this is Ayn Rand's unique perspective, to attain happiness, so far from being extraordinarily difficult, is the simplest thing in the world. If she were here, she would say, all you have to do is live. Just as to attain certainty is the simplest thing in the world, because all you have to do is think. See, you stole my punchline. Now, having surveyed these two, let's ask, in conclusion, what is the fundamental philosophic issue underlying the anti-happiness, anti-certainty viewpoint, or putting it positively, what is the issue at the root of the objectivist view on these two questions? Let's start with the topic of happiness. What is the deepest root of the objectivist view of happiness? In other words, of the view that the moral is the practical and the happy, therefore, the normal. Well, it's easier to approach this question, I think, in reverse by asking, why are men content to regard happiness as an unattainable yearning, to regard it as practically desirable and then insist that the moral and the practical are opposites? Or let's put it this way, why have men been content to live with so insufferable a contradiction as the moral-practical dichotomy? Why have they not indignantly rejected the conventional ethics precisely because it is impracticable, leads to misery, and says so? Now, if you can answer that, then you know what is that operating underneath the moral level here. And of course, you know that the roots of ethics are in fundamental philosophy. Now, the most obvious of the deeper issues at work here is what? Now, if you don't say the right one, it's no good, because I want to go a step at a time. What is the most obvious of the deeper issues at work here? The soul-body dichotomy. Because an advocate of this viewpoint merely shrugs resignedly when he sees that the moral code he preaches leads to disasters in practice. Everyone knows, he says, that morality is a spiritual concern, and that the spiritual is opposed to the physical. So the choice, therefore, is cling to the soul, retire idealistically into the church or the desert, and be canonized in due course as a person who hateth his life, or cling to the world by retiring from morality. Now you see that both sides in this choice agree on one crucial point, that morality as such by its very nature is useless and even harmful. It's harmful in this life, says one side. It's harmful in real life, says the other. Life, accordingly, requires not virtue in any definition but expediency. And that takes us another step. We can put the agreement this way. Principles to guide one's choices, both sides agree, are not a necessity of successful action. They are not a necessity of happiness here and now and on this earth. On the contrary, both schools agree that principles, any kind of principles, are an otherworldly impediment, a spiritual thorn in one's flesh, in effect, to be masochistically endured or amorally plucked out. One choice gives us the self-sacrificing ascetic, the other the whim-worshipping hedonist. That is a very crucial point here. In the dominant philosophy of our time, the vital power of principle is set in reverse. It is detached from the work of self-preservation and moves to the side of the anti-life. Now the question is, how could anyone defend or accept such a perverse view of principle? Principle as being the enemy of life. And now we're on the threshold of the answer. What is a principle? A form of conceptualization. To pit principles against life is to pit concepts against life, which means to accept a breach between concepts and reality. And that in turn presupposes a certain view of concepts. Nothing, I believe this very deeply, nothing but a false theory of concepts can explain the worldwide scorn today for the conceptual guidance offered by principles. Such scorn would be impossible and astonishing to a man who regarded concepts as the means of knowing existence. But it's necessary to the disciples of intrinsicism and subjectivism who make abstractions useless by detaching them from percepts. The intrinsicists then have the effrontery to build on this very uselessness. Be loyal to principles apart from reality, they say, and suffer the consequences here on earth. To which the subjectivists reply, that is the price of being principled, and it's too high, so anything goes. The one mentality tells us abstractions, including those of the evaluative variety, do not pay off in this world, which they don't, not in his interpretation. The other shrugs, so much for abstractions, now let's be practical. And that's the awesome spectacle created by both sides. The spectacle of the rational being, man, asserting as a truism the fantastic notion that his distinctive cognitive faculty, the conceptual faculty, is an obstacle to his survival. And yet that is the conventional wisdom today. Only philosophers could create a disaster of this magnitude. No individual errors of content, however great, could cause an entire species to disdain its means of cognition. Only a warped view of the human mind itself, which means only a corrupt theory of concepts, could lead our species to this kind of disdain. When men accept a fundamentally false view of concepts, as in intrinsicism or subjectivism, they introduce a breach between consciousness and existence at the base of their thinking. And this is the only way to introduce such a breach. You cannot introduce a breach on the perceptual level. Why not? The perceptual level automatically conforms to reality. If you want to split man's consciousness from reality, you can do it only on the conceptual level, only by severing concepts as such from percepts, which is exactly what a false theory of concepts does across the board. And then, inevitably, that breach infects a man's thinking on every question. And thus, in epistemology, people conclude that certainty is impossible. Concepts, they feel, have no connection to perceptual reality. They're merely a linguistic game, unable to bring us real, absolute knowledge. And in ethics, that same breach between concepts and percepts makes people feel inevitably that the moral and the practical are opposites, that the choice is self-sacrifice or whim worship, in other words, that the road to happiness as to knowledge is closed off. I would say, given the conventional view of concepts, skepticism and malevolence are unavoidable. These ubiquitous expressions of failure and doom are not insignificant. These bromides we hear everywhere about how we're destined to failure, ignorance, and misery. That is telltale symptoms of error, of a lethal error at the very heart of the prevalent worldview. It's a symptom of philosophers' inability to grasp the relationship between concepts and persons. The objectivist philosophy, by contrast, our affirmation of certainty and of the harmony of the moral, the practical, and the happy, is also a culmination. We uphold these benevolent conclusions because long before we reach such issues, we uphold their precondition, an objective view of concepts. Morality, we say, is practical because consciousness is practical. And consciousness is practical. It's efficacious in thought and in action because its tool, concepts, is man's means of knowing perceptual reality. Let me, in conclusion, quote Ayn Rand's crucial statement. Consciousness is practical because it is, quote, the faculty of perceiving that which exists. Now, all you have to do, unquote, all you have to do to reach every other objectivist conclusion is to stick with this formulation of Ayn Rand all the way. For further details, I refer you to my next book. Thank you. Thank you, Ben.